Greetings, friends, and thanks for tuning in to the Prepare.ai podcast, where we explore the fast-paced world of emerging technologies and how they impact the human experience. I'm Foley Teasdale, Executive Director of Prepare.ai and a tech enthusiast who's focused on product, marketing, and innovation.
And I'm Dave Costanero, Technical Director of Prepare and Chief Data Officer at Capacity, an AI startup. I'm the engineering and data science yin to Foley's liberal arts yang. Each episode, we interview someone who inspires us in the world of AI and tech, with the goal of making it all a little more approachable and accessible.
If you like what you hear, help us out by searching for Prepare.ai podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite listening platform. Hit subscribe and leave a rating or review.
Hello and welcome, everyone. Today we're here with Kristen Dennis. She's the Chief Operating Officer of Impossible Sensing, a St. Louis-based company that develops next-generation sensing applications for deployment in extreme terrestrial and extraterrestrial environments. They developed two laser spectroscopy systems for the Mars Perseverance rover and are currently collaborating with NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab and SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, on a deep ocean mission. Before joining Impossible Sensing, Kristen spent many years working in surgical ocular recovery for transplant, sterile technique, and operating room procedures. Kristen, welcome to the program.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
How would you describe to an eight-year-old what Impossible Sensing does, using maybe Perseverance for reference?
This is a great question to ask me because the limits of my understanding to how the technology actually works is probably somewhere in that eight-year-old operating range. And really the simplest way to kind of put it is you want to look at something, you want to know about it. And what we can do is we take light, so maybe using a laser, and we can focus that light on something we want to find out about. And by the way that the light interacts with the sample or the object, we can learn about it in a lot of different ways. And so for instance, on the rover, on the Mars 2020 rover right now on Perseverance, we have a laser, which is basically just a little light. And we're going to focus it on something that kind of looks interesting, that the camera's identified as interesting. And we're going to shoot the light at it and find out a little bit more about it. And then what happens is it either gets tagged as something we're going to eventually come back for, like super interesting. We still don't know how we're going to come back and get it. Or it's just like, this is boring. This isn't what we're looking for.
So with the laser, you can make a more precise measurement of something like the mass, or what are some of the other things that you would be teasing out of it that the camera, a visual camera, can't see?
We can look for things like composition. We can see the chemistry, the makeup of what the thing actually is. Now, if we're on Mars and we're looking for life, we can look for maybe certain biosignatures or things that we expect may be produced as a, you know, a side effect of life having been there, like a pigment or a salt. And so we're kind of scanning for particular compounds. And then we can also tell where in the sample or where in the area of interest those things are, which gives us a little bit more detailed information.
And you did mention you don't know how you're going to get these samples back. Is it true that there's like a proposal out there to try to figure out how to get samples back from Mars?
Yes. This is a little above my pay grade. This is a problem for NASA that we're really trying to figure out is, okay, so you have a rover, it's putting samples in, you know, maybe a titanium capsule or something like that, leaving them on the surface of Mars for us to recover eventually. But how do you find those things on a planet with no GPS, you know? So there's a lot of smart people working on this problem. I've heard one person call it the Fetch Rover, which I love. I don't know if they'll really call it that or not, but I thought that was great. It's a really interesting challenge to locate something on the surface of Mars that isn't directly, you know, connected with something that's speaking like a rover or the Ingenuity, the helicopter. So that'll be a really interesting challenge. And it'll be really fascinating to actually eventually get samples back from Mars.
So that is the plan.
That is the plan.
We're not sure how or when.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, cool. Someday in the future, in an incredibly smart way.
That's so awesome. So, okay, let's talk about deep ocean work a little bit. And I've heard this before, because I'm a little bit of a nerd around like treasure hunting, and I've read some books about recovering, you know, ships that were lost for 150 years and then having to develop technology to get down there. And I understand that like it's harder to develop technology to operate in such deep pressure than it is in a vacuum.
Yeah, it's really, really challenging. We know how to build stuff in a vacuum. There are particular challenges to it, but it's much, much easier than building something for the pressures that exist at the bottom of the ocean. It's an interesting problem, but we do have technology solutions that meet that. It's just you can put something in a housing, and then it has to actually work in that housing, and then it has to be not knocked over by a fish. Or, you know, there's a lot of things going on the bottom of the ocean that aren't really happening in the vacuum of space. So we actually have a mission coming up to the bottom of the ocean, partnered with, I think you had mentioned this, with JPL, NASA JPL in California, and with SETI in the Bay Area. SETI stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, which is really interesting how it plays into our mission. So what we're going to do is we're going to put an instrument. It's going to sit on a tower, and it's going to study this particular area of interest. It's these ocean vents. And what happens at these vent sites is that we've got super, super heated water because there's a little crack in the ocean floor. And what's happening is creating this just element soup down there with all sorts of things that are just breaking down and reforming. And you get these kind of clouds of material that are coming out of these vents and then falling back down to create almost like a little mini mountain under the ocean. And so what our Invader mission is going to do, and that's the name of it, is going to go and observe what's happening, not just in a snapshot, which has been done before, but what's actually happening down there over time. So the goal is to have it set down there for a year and take these measurements, see what's happening, and learn a lot about our ocean ecosystem around this. But what we're also doing is, here's where SETI comes in, is thinking about Earth as an analog for other planets with oceans. We know that there are some icy moons like Titan or Enceladus that we believe have the same kind of activity on the floor of their oceans, where we've got some heat coming from the core, and we've got maybe some activity down there. And so what we're trying to learn, not only about our own ocean, but what ocean exploration might be like on other planets.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, and the interesting part about this is they think perhaps that life on our own planet started around these systems, because of the heat, because of everything breaking down and reforming. So what we would be doing on maybe an ocean world would be looking and thinking, this is possibly a good place to look for life here as well.
So what does the sensor array look like there? Are you guys the only thing going with the laser sensors, or are there other things gathering other data?
For Invader, nope, it's just us. And we are going down. It gets brought down by a ROV, or underwater. Gosh, there's so many acronyms. Unmanned underwater vehicle, AUV. It gets brought down. I think its name is Jason. It's a very famous underwater robot.
That's simpler, Jason.
Yeah, I love Jason. Jason does all the missions. You see him on every ocean documentary. I love Jason. So I think Jason or one of its siblings will be taking our instrument down there and setting it up. And they take it out on this big cruise. And so there are lots of other scientists on the cruise that have different objectives that we're all kind of sharing time on the boat. But the particular mission will just be us.
Okay. What does the data backhaul system look like? Are you getting data in real time, or is it batched and sent by radio frequency or a wire, or how does that work?
It's actually really interesting. So our CEO Pablo has this ocean hero guy, and he convinced the U.S. government to put essentially fiber optic cable on the bottom of the ocean that scientists can just boop, plug right into and access power and the ability to transmit data. And so Invader will be plugging into this fiber optic kind of big array cable to be able to send us data in real time. And that's really important for us to be able to see how it's working.
Wow, that's pretty neat. I wonder who else might be using that. It's just diving and you see a plug and you charge your phone in while you're scuba diving.
Exactly.
So how are your sensors different, unique, or better than other sensors that, you know, somebody might be familiar with? You know, I got my phone, it's got an accelerometer in it, and it's got a camera and a light sensor to dim the screen and those types of things. What are sort of the unique things that are different about your sensors?
So what we try to do is kind of address technical challenges that most people aren't addressing because the cost is really high or because the problem is super unique. And we kind of, it's the techniques that we're using that are kind of the unique aspect of it. So what the techniques that we're using include like LIBS, which is laser induced breakdown spectroscopy. Now people use LIBS for different things, but people don't use it in exactly kind of the black box way that we use it, where you can actually embed it in an instrument. It's going to be smaller than typical instruments because we've gotten really good at miniaturizing. It's going to be lower weight because when we put something on maybe a space instrument, or if you're putting something on a drone, you want it to be very light. And we also consume very little power. So size, weight, and power requirements are a big thing when you're trying to send something to space. And so what we've gotten very good is taking something that would maybe be the size of a washing machine and making it the size of maybe a cell phone. And so that gives us a lot of advantage to be able to take techniques that otherwise would require a lot of payload and a lot of work to get there to places that you couldn't get to before. And then also a lot of things that we work on that make our instruments unique is that we use very few moving parts. We've innovated ways to look at things, you know, either with a lens or with a LED that isn't going to be required to move a lot of parts to do, because, you know, the more moving parts, the more complex it is, the more it can break. And if you send something to Mars, you can't just go fix it. So it just has to get there and it has to work.
Oh, cool. And the sensor, so are you all gathering data in real time? And then where is the data going? Is it going to you all for analysis, or is it going to NASA, or both?
Well, for the rover right now, it's an interesting thing because it's mostly real time. We're on about a 7-minute delay from Mars just because it is very, very far away. But the data is coming to our lab. And our scientists there, particularly our scientist Anastasia Yanchulina, is actually looking at that data and helping NASA interpret it. And it's very wild to be, you know, on Cherokee Street in South St. Louis and be looking at characteristics of a rock on Mars in the Jezero crater. So that's really, really exciting for us to really be able to see and help NASA interpret that data.
Do you all need clearance? Like, is this top secret kind of stuff that you've got folks who are, you know, have security clearance or not?
I wish it was like that cool where I had like a secret badge that got me into some like 7-layer basement in NASA. No, not really. The kind of most they put us through is doing like the annual technology training where they teach you not to get phished in an email, which is, you know, that's helpful information. But what we do for NASA, most of the time what we're operating is as independent contractors working directly with them. So there is always a concern between both parties or all parties involved for proprietary information. But also when NASA purchases an instrument, or, you know, they say, hey, we're going to give you this grant to develop this thing. We develop that for them and they get the know-how that goes with it as well. And so there is a really nice symbiotic relationship of like, hey, we're going to pay you to make this thing. And then we make the thing. And then the information is shared. And now the information is available for future missions. But we also retain the right to use that our own, whichever way we, you know, want to do. We could do another instrument. We could continue to expand that technique. What we really want to do, and this is actually part of NASA's mission and in the SBIR program, which is small business grants, they really want you to take what they help you develop and transfer that technology into the U.S. economy, right? So it's a really interesting process where they're funding research and then they're getting something out of it. But what they're also hoping is that, for instance, Velcro, styrofoam, astronaut ice cream, which is maybe one of the less interesting things that have come out of it. But all these things have come out of NASA dollars being spent to help missions and astronauts in space and things like that, but have been transferred into the U.S. economy to really generate GDP. And so it's a really successful approach to industry. I it's been very good for us.
Yeah. So, you know, what do you see any line of sight to commercial applications expanding like that, like these spinoffs that you're talking about, like things that you're developing for volcanic vents on the ocean floor or for Mars expeditions? Are you working to commercialize some of your applications in any industries or other applications?
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely do take that as part of our mission as well. There's right now we are working with a different government agency to develop another ocean project, a much smaller instrument. Invader's pretty large. This would be a smaller instrument that would be mobile. And what it would do, what it will do, is it'll be deployed either singularly or eventually in swarms on the ocean floor to really start to understand what resources we have there. You hear a lot about the green economy, you know, green tech, things that we need for batteries and windmills. And we don't have a lot of that stuff on the mainland in the US. Most of it we're getting from China. But we do have a lot of that on the continental shelf or on our sea floor in the economic zone. And the concern is that as that becomes more valuable, people are going to go down, you know, your big oil companies, your mining companies, and just tear up the ocean, which is really concerning on a number of levels. And so one of the problems we see that we can help to solve is to help the U.S. government, first of all, identify where these resource deposits are, you know, by using a, like, again, like a laser that's able to kind of scan and map and show, you know, hey, there's a huge nickel deposit here. There's cobalt over here. And then on top of that, make a qualitative decision, because what we're going to also say is, here's this deposit of cobalt, but on top of this is this very, very vibrant bio community. The qualitative decision can then be made. Should we just leave this alone because we want to preserve the animals and plant life and things that are happening in that benthic community? And so one of the great things that we're really hoping that learning from this Invader mission and now going into this new development is to help the U.S. map these resources so that we can sustainably recover them from the ocean floor, and also create zones kind of like national parks on the bottom of the ocean where we say, hey, this is off limits. And that's really exciting for us. We really want to, you know, we're looking for life and we're doing all these far flung things on the moon and other planets. And we also want to be good stewards of our own planet. And so when we talk about spinning off technology or transferring it into the economy, we really want to focus on green, sustainable stuff. We're also working with some partners in Canada on creating a zero emission well pad. There's a ton of greenhouse gases, methane gases and things like that, that are released, you know, around the recovery of oil and gas and the refinement process. And so we have several solutions that we're working with partners to try to also contain, cap, or at least identify those emissions during the process. And then one of the other more interesting things we've been looking at is we were working with the Department of Energy on a project right now related to soil health. and using a laser to get some key indicators for soil health, which would be, kind of the research side of it. And then we're currently working with some people in St. Louis to then spin that out into a solution that could actually be used by the ag tech folks right here in the Midwest.
Wow, that's a lot of irons in the fire. That's
it's a lot of irons. I only mentioned some of the irons, actually.
Nice. You know, it's interesting when you talk about the first thing you mentioned about, you know, biodiversity on the bottom of the ocean, and do we drill there for these rare earth metals and other resources that might be valuable? I just was watching this Netflix documentary. David Attenborough, you know, is 94 now. And, you know, he made this special, and he's kind of like summing up his extraordinary life with the plea for biodiversity. And I just think, like, when someone has had has that many years of experience and has had that extraordinary of a life, like, it's worth like listening to what that person wants to say.
Absolutely. Really, well, because somebody with that long of a lifespan has seen how things play out over time, right? Mm. People can be very, very short-sighted when it comes to resource production or recovery, and sometimes that's a lack of technology. And so in that case, if it is a lack of technology and we can contribute to it, we're trying to kind of take a longer view of how these activities really do affect not only life on the bottom of the ocean, but life for us here, you know, topside. Our earth is all connected. All these communities are connected environmentally, and taking a long view, it hopefully will allow us to continue to be around.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So Kristen, can you tell us just the Cliff Notes version of how did Impossible Sensing get started? How did it gain momentum in the kind of tech entrepreneurial ecosystem? Where did it get funding, ideas, staffing, a little bit of story?
Yeah, absolutely. So our CEO, Pablo, was working kind of as a like genius for hire for different space agencies. He was working at the Canadian Space Agency. He was doing stuff for NASA, and he was doing some stuff for Washington University in St. Louis, which actually it has a lot of funding and momentum towards space programs. And he got kind of frustrated with the pace of government. If anybody's worked with government, you know, they always pay, but they are very slow. And, you know, when you're talking about kind of cutting edge innovation, it can feel like a lot of weight slowing you down. And so what he decided to do in 2016 was to start a company and try to do this much faster, more iterative, and keep up with, you know, how fast the technology could move. And so from 2016, now what year is it? 2021. For the first couple of years, it was just him. You know, he had a tinker shop in his apartment. It was kind of awesome. All these tools, you know, soldering and whiteboards with math, you know, kind of going all around the room and da da da. And it started, he did really well, and people started to pay attention. He got several really cool grants from NASA and was able to develop some key technologies, including Invader mission. So he got that when he was just one person. Now, of course, we have a great team that with JPL, our colleagues there and colleagues at SETI. But fairly quickly, all of this starts happening, and now you've got a write contracts, and you've got to answer all these emails, and you can't just sit and build the thing in your apartment. And so I had known him from St. Louis. We had just met in the neighborhood. We live in the same neighborhood. And I had met him, and we were chitty chatting at a bar, and I was like, oh, you and your friends all like science. I like science. Cool. Let's nerd out, you know? And so that's how we became friends. And, I think it must've been 2018, this point, 2019. He kind of was just like, I need help. Can you do this? What do I do? And I was like, okay, I'll write a job description. I'll tell you what title, and I'll show you how to hire me. And so we started there, and very quickly we're able to just snag some really incredible minds from all the way from the Silicon Valley area to right here in St. Louis. We have an incredible talent pool coming out of the universities here for engineering and science. And now we're 14 people, and we've got a lab here in South City, and we just got 4 new interns. So I think it's a measure of success if you've got interns, right? We love our interns. The thing that really I found fascinating when he kind of pitched this idea to me was the idea of creating a West Coast tech company in the Midwest, and taking advantage of the climate here, how interested people are, because it's not just, oh, another founder is pitching me an idea, goody. The cost of living is great. You know, our scientist that moved from California, he couldn't believe the type of house that he could rent. He's like, I have a room I don't even know what to do with, you know? So it's really advantageous for us to be here in the sense that we can attract and keep people, but also it's a little bit easier to fail in a city like St. Louis. You know, when you're doing all this cutting edge R&D, sometimes it just doesn't work. Sometimes you just can't break the laws of physics. Sometimes we try. And so when you're kind of trying things, the risk can be incredibly high, particularly when it's very costly to make a mistake. And in St. Louis, we're able to take a little bit more of a risk because the cost is going to be much lower and we can pick ourselves up and try something else. So that's been a really cool operating measure that we've been able to employ by being a company here. And so now at 14 folks, well, 18 with the interns, we are continuing to get more and more grants. We're starting to now develop a little bit more of the corporate citizenship stuff that we weren't able to do when everyone just had their heads down trying to put screws and solder things. And so we've done some community outreach things. We're looking at expanding youth education programs and things like that. Because another interesting thing about working for NASA or partnering with NASA and other government agencies is that those agencies are funded by tax dollars. And we are very much aware of the fact that all, including us, but all of us are paying for this research. And so we really want to make sure, and it's kind of NASA's mandate that we also have adopted, is that we're giving back to our community in what ways we can. And that might just be, you know, sponsoring. We're in a very artistic area down here in Cherokee Street, so sponsoring a cool mural or doing a series. Right now we're doing a series called Bar Trek, where we go to different watering holes in the city and we bring in a scientist to just talk, kind of regular people talk about a subject. So we're doing a moon one. We did an ocean one. And people can actually interact in real time with their tax dollars in a way that typically you don't get to do.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And it's really fun because, you know, it's interesting stuff. So we get just wild questions. I love it.
That's so great. I love the idea of sort of taking the work out into the community. And because I think, you know, we don't necessarily get enough of that. And especially in the real world, like now that we can go back to the real world, it's not just videos or, you know, kind of one way conversation, but that you're creating two way conversations is really neat.
Yeah. It's been a really nice exercise, and it's something we'll continue to pursue. Is you should be able to interact with the people who are making the Mars rover, you know, why not? We're here.
So with the Mars rover, for example, like, do you have any idea how many private companies participated in the effort to get, you know, to develop the rover and get it to Mars?
A lot. You know, it was built at JPL, you know, in their big rover building room. It's so awesome. You've got the guys in the, you know, the bunny suits and goggles because no dust and germs, and really, really cool. So they really put everything together, but kind of like, you know, the Sherlock instrument that we had a hand in the SuperCam, They're bringing in all kinds of folks from around the country and around the world, really to develop all of this, because it is such a huge effort. And if you really look at the rover, and NASA has some really cool graphics on their website where you can kind of spin it, you can see where the instrument's set. There are a lot of components. There are a lot of things going on, and they are all, you know, very, very high tech, very, very cutting edge. And I can't imagine that even just one single company or even a handful of companies could accomplish that. So NASA does a really cool job of creating collaborative efforts and moving technology forward in that way.
That's super cool.
We're just a little piece of it.
That's so neat. All right. We have a segment we call We Got Jokes, where we tell nerdy parent jokes. So did you bring a joke? I hope you did.
I did. I'm notoriously bad at remembering jokes. Yeah. And I love when kids tell me jokes. I'm like, oh, I got to remember that one, because that one's really good. And I don't write them down. But there's one dorky joke that I was thinking of. We were talking about it at the lab, that I do remember. And I had to look it up to make sure I got it right. But it's, shall I tell it?
Yes, we're ready.
It's how many programmers does it take to change a light bulb?
How many?
None. It's a hardware issue. Ha ha.
Nice.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a deep cut, but you know, if it feels like a kind of a nerdy vibe, we can nerd out a little bit.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. All right. I brought a Mars one today.
Good.
What did Mars say to Saturn? Give me a ring sometime.
Oh, that's great.
Waka waka. All right, here's one. I saw a 1-star review for Mars on Yelp. They said it lacked atmosphere.
Perfect.
Really good one too.
Space jokes are the best. You can, I mean, you can really go on and on. There's a lot to work with.
Should we move on to the riff? We have this. Great. Okay. So Kristen, we have this segment that we call the riff, where we like to riff on ideas to kind of like, you know, move the ball forward on solutions, make the world a better place. You know, fully, maybe we should start calling this like the magic wand segment. Because really what we want to do, Kristen, is we want to give you a hypothetical magic wand. If you had your magic wand and could, like, from your seat in the room, change, you know, one or a handful of things about the world to make things better with, you know, with sensing or private public partnerships or getting kids interested in space or biodiversity, getting spinoffs, technology spinoffs into people to benefit people more quickly or more broadly. Like, what is the one or handful of things that you would do with your magic wand?
I would like to have a tricorder, like what they had in Star Trek, where you could take our laser tech, and people have asked us to, they're like, can you kind of build this? And we're like, I think you're trying to get a tricorder. I would love for that to be a real thing, because now my history and my career up until this point has been in medicine. And I've always been very, very interested in the idea of curing disease, and not only that, but figuring out the pathologies and why those diseases take hold. And I think that's a question that sometimes has to be analyzed. Like, if you do, you know, testing and stuff like that, as we learned with COVID, it takes time to get results, right? And if I had a magic wand, I would somehow make this tricorder that everybody wants us to build work, and that we could really in real time start to do diagnoses of some of the biggest and most pervasive problems that we have in infectious disease. And not only that, but it would be small enough, light enough, and require so little power that now we can use this in places where people don't typically have access to traditional healthcare.
So cool.
It would be so world-changing for us to be able to work with an instrument that would do all of this in places where typically, yeah, you don't have access, or you can't run those tests, or you can't have a lab. I think that we do have a lot of resources here in St. Louis as far as biotech. And we will continue to seek ways to partner with them. And I really do hope that we can eventually find a way to make some inroads there.
That's fascinating. So for people who may not be familiar, this is the device on Star Trek, right? Could you describe it?
Yeah. Oh, it's awesome. It does everything. It's like a little handheld kind of remote control with these kind of ears that go up and they light up and they tell the doctor everything and anything in real time of what's happening. You know, if Worf or gets injured or he's got some kind of space alien disease, you know, she can just wave this truly magic wand in some ways. And it does a real time diagnosis.
So it would be, I mean, with your mass, was it LIDS?
LIDS is, that actually makes our sample into plasma and it would not feel super good to be LIDSed. We do work in, you know, pretty much the entire spectrum of light. So way down into terahertz and all the way into UV. There are plenty of parts of that spectrum or techniques that don't require me making you into plasma to understand what's going on.
that would be much preferred.
Yeah.
So like sensing and all of the like subtle things that we maybe aren't measuring and telling, hey, this person has this condition or this thing is happening. That's cool. Yeah. Isn't there a prize, like an X prize or like the tricorder prize?
There is. There is, and somebody won it. But it's not quite there yet because I believe it has a couple gel pads you got to stick on you. And it's an incredible innovation, but it's also, from what I understand, not quite getting into the parts per million or billion that are needed and required to diagnose certain diseases that are really hard to see. But it's a very cool prize and a very cool step for sure.
Gotcha. So like maybe is that like a stage one of the prize? Like you have to go through thresholds of miniaturization, price point and capability, and maybe this only won a few of those.
Yeah. I think there were maybe two or three teams. Now I'm totally out of my depth because I remember reading about it, but they had done really, really incredible work. It's just, it is very, very difficult to look for these things with any technique, and now try to put that in a handheld device and you're really up against some challenges.
Yeah, man. I love it. You guys should get on that.
Yeah. Well, we'll try. We did work. There's a really cool group out of WashU. It's students, and they provide market research in different fields to try to help. You know, a lot of times it's like a scientist or a professor that has this really good idea, but doesn't know how to translate it to the market. And we did find some really interesting data about our technology being able to perhaps do early diagnosis of rheumatoid arthritis. Which is really just a terrible condition for people to suffer through. And you can really only diagnose it once it's so bad that you notice it. So there are definitely applications that we can pursue. It's just kind of finding the right point in which to enter that whole different market, very different from space. I mean, send the thing to space, it blows up, everybody cries, but nobody gets hurt. medicine is a little more challenging because we're working with human beings.
Yeah. It's reminding me of, you know, talking about like sensing disease. There's a program called Hero Rats that has been, you can adopt a rat and it costs like $50. And I think, the rats are designed to do two things. One is they can detect, landmines. And so, whoa. Yeah, so they put them, and I don't know how, but I think it's scent. And then the second is they can detect TB. They can detect tuberculosis.
Wow. Yeah, one of the biggest pervasive diseases happening now in the world.
Yeah. I read an article about a woman whose husband had Parkinson's. And she, as they were starting to go to different doctors and stuff, I think they went to a clinic. And she literally was like, everyone smells like you. And they figured out that she was like a super sniffer and that she could actually smell Parkinson's.
Wow.
And like there's, you know, there are all these senses that we are just starting to get a handle on and be able to, you know, capitalize on, hopefully. It's really interesting. Wow.
That's amazing. I that's, we work with little robots that can sense things. I don't know about the rats, but it sounds like they're much cuter.
Can we make the robots smell?
Yeah. I mean, kind of, that's sort of what they're doing. I guess we can analyze. There was one really interesting, somebody through T-Rex had asked us to try to make a sensor that could sniff out cocaine, like from that's being smuggled like through South America. Yeah. And it would be kind of a sniffer bot that would fly over the canopy and sniff for these manufactories that are very, very hidden and very hard to find. We never ended up making it, but there are applications that we could use, you know, lasers to kind of sniff.
That's super cool.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. We also have a segment we call Word Association. We're just going to throw some random words at you and you tell us the first thing that comes to mind. It doesn't have to be a single word. It can be a sentence or a paragraph. Dave, you want to go first?
Sure. So first word, UAPs or UFOs?
Ooh, well, there's a lot happening with that right now. The government's like, yeah, they exist. The uninteresting thing is that, well, of course they exist. We don't know everything that's flying around. I really hope that they're aliens though. Yeah, they're unidentified. That doesn't mean they're alien. Now, I would prefer the alien part.
Yeah. And I was, when you said SETI and ocean, I was like, ooh, because I know it, like in some of the videos that they're now releasing and the interviews, like some of these Navy pilots have seen that these, you know, UAPs are like disappearing into the ocean.
Great. I mean, Atlantis is real. I don't know. Can't wait. Can't wait to find out.
What does UAP stand for?
Unidentified aerial phenomena.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
I think they're trying to like get away from the idea of like little green men and a.
So they're trying to like say maybe it's like a will-o'-the-wisp, like it's a phenomenon.
I know. It's a weird, word.
It makes it seem exciting, I guess.
Well, it is exciting.
Agree.
All right. Gathering for in-person events.
Yay. We definitely, at Impossible, really were very, very good at doing a lot of fun happy hours. I would say that we happy hour well as a company. And during the, you know, 2020 and the last, you know, year and more, we were like, okay, how do we translate this into digital, I guess, because that's what we're doing. And we did it. We did a science happy hour every other week with the whole team on Zoom or Teams. And well, we tried it. It got awkward. And so we're just like, you know how these things go. And so we are very, very happy to be able to not only be in the lab again, because we had to schedule around each other. Nobody could be in the lab. And we're really, really excited to be able to be out in our community. And this is where the good ideas kind of happen, right? You have a beer, you hang out, you chat about a problem, and all of a sudden you're solving all the world's problems on the whiteboard, you know? So.
Nice. Awesome. Okay. Next term, space weather.
Ooh, space weather. I like space weather. There's, let's see, what is it? Super critical CO2 that creates a bunch of space weather on Venus that basically eats everything up. Is that right? That's some pretty awesome weather. Oh, solar storms. Those are awesome. Yeah. Space weather is about the most epic weather you could get, I guess. Love that.
Nice. All right. Microchip supply chain shortage.
Ugh.
Is it impacting you all? Like,
Not so much. We have had some issues with supply chain just during all of that because people can't come into work and make the stuff, right? But we've actually been pretty okay as far as that goes. On a personal side, I ordered a kayak last year in June, didn't get it till September. So that was annoying.
Bummer. Okay. So our last segment here, we call it Smorgasbord. It's just some, some questions to get to know you a little bit better. So first question, if you could spend 24 hours anywhere in the known universe, where would you go?
Ooh, anywhere in the known universe. And I wouldn't implode or be eaten by acid weather.
You're in an impossible sensing housing, protected.
Man, maybe this is kind of a boring answer, but I think I would love to be on Earth's moon. Mm-hmm. I find it so visually interesting and strange. You know, it's just so dead and so monochromatic. And also the icon that, you know, I grew up with seeing, you know, this is landing on the moon and we put the flag and then we see the footprints. And I think that if I could just walk around kind of by myself and just observe it and be in that absolute desolate space and then look and see our own planet from the outside perspective, I think that would be really powerful. And you know what, kind of in reach, you know, I'm confident that we're going to have people on the moon soon. And, you know, who knows? It could inspire a lot of really interesting art. Oh. I think I would like it. I think I'd be up there observing quietly.
I love that. That's a great answer. What is your favorite guilty pleasure coming out of the pandemic?
Ooh, sharing food. I think I missed sharing, like going to a place and getting all the foods and then like, oh, give me some of that and I'll give you some of this. And like, and also now I'm very hyper aware of it. Now it's okay, right? Because, you know, I'm vaccinated and a bunch of my friends are. And so we're like, this is okay. It feels weird. It's okay. It does feel weird. Let's do it anyway, you know? And that's been just such a treat to be able to do that because I love having like a little bite of everybody else's food.
I wonder if buffets will ever come back.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Or maybe we've just kind of deleted that. And I'm fine with that too.
Ooh, I would be. I would mourn the loss.
I like you're saying, I like a little bit of many things.
Yeah.
And the buffet can do, I'm an introvert. So the buffet can do that for me without me having to talk to anyone.
Oh, there you go. Oh yeah. Just a solo mission.
Yeah, exactly.
There is. Okay. What song or band are you most likely to rock out to in the car?
Ooh. Well, I play music and recently, well, so right before pandemic, I had this band years ago and we toured and made records and did this thing. And then I got kind of busy with work and didn't do it. And then right before pandemic happened, we were supposed to play a reunion show on the roof of the last hotel. It was going to be this whole thing. And it's like, all right, cool. And we practiced and then pandemic. And so that never happened. And now that everybody in the band is vaccinated again, we've been playing music and I started listening to some of the stuff that we had done before. I was like, oh, we're pretty good. So, so that's been fun to check out for sure.
What's the name of the band? We'll put it in the show notes.
Oh, sure. The name of the band is Nee, N-E-E. We do have a record on Spotify. That's how I listen to my own music because like that's the only access I have to it now. And in St. Louis, there's just, I think a lot of people doing really, really cool stuff. So I'd like to listen to some local music and, just drive around.
Nice.
Cool. All right. This is our last question. I love this one. If someone were to gift you $100,000 in shares of any company on earth that you could not sell for 20 years, what company would you want it to be?
Ooh. That's a really, really good question. And maybe, you know, I guess I couldn't name a specific company, but I would probably invest now having learned so much about these ocean resource economic problems and some of the folks that are working in that sphere. I think that would be a really interesting place to invest because I think what's going to start happening, and it's going to take a while, so maybe 20 years is a good timeline, is we are going to see a lot of money and energy and effort being funneled into recovering these ocean resources. And what I would like to do is invest in a company, you know, that has a similar kind of ethos as us, which is to do that sustainably. And I think that there's going to be an emerging market there for sure.
That's a great answer. That's really cool.
Well, it's the only answer I could give you by squirming around, not actually naming a single company.
That's valid response.
Sure.
So, Kristen, this has been awesome. We want to give you the last word. Is there anything that we didn't cover or anything that you'd like to say or mention or promote?
No, I really do think the public outreach stuff we've been doing lately has been fun. And, you know, if anybody is in the St. Louis area and wants to check that out, would definitely encourage people to come and talk to us. We want to be a very community focused organization, and St. Louis provides a really nice, place to do that. And so, look out for probably more stuff we'll be doing now, again, that live events are back. And, yeah, we're just really, really looking forward to all the things that we're going to be able to do here, in the future.
Well, we are going to be holding, an event in the fall, and we would love to have you. So.
Right. Yes. Events. Let's do them all. Yes. My bar for content is so low right now. I'll go to anything, do anything, see any band. No, that sounds exciting. For sure.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning. And it's just awesome to have Impossible Sensing here. So I'm happy we got to learn more about it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. This is fun. I love to nerd out. So this is ideal.
Awesome. Great. Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in to the Prepare.ai podcast. If you like the show, search Prepare.ai podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite listening platform. Hit subscribe and leave us a rating or a review. The Prepare.ai podcast is produced by Dave Costanero and Foley Teasdale. Our sound engineer is Michael Bonfard.
Prepare is a 501c3 nonprofit organization whose mission is to increase awareness of, access to, and collaboration around AI and other fourth industrial revolution technologies in order to advance the human experience.
We're doing it from the heart of the Midwest, where the first and second industrial revolutions brought growth and innovation, and where the third eroded jobs and urban landscapes.
This time, we will not be left behind. We will lead, not follow. Thank you for helping us prepare. Thank you.